Hi, everyone. Welcome to the third episode of the Sfarim Chatter Shabbat ISV series. On this episode of the series, I spoke with Professor Yaakov Dweck, who's a professor at Princeton, and we discussed Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis, who is the focus of Professor Dweck's newest book entitled Dissident Rabbi from Princeton University Press. And we particularly discussed Rabbi Yaakov Sosportis and his work, Tzitzis Nevel Tzvi, which is about the history and Sabbatian movement, and he was the main opponent during the main period of when Shabbat Tzvi was, I guess, active in 1665, 1666, well, before that, after that, and he recounts all this in his Tzitzis Nevel Tzvi. So we discussed him, his life, and various different aspects of that. I would like to once again thank the corporate sponsor of the series, Gluck Plumbing, for all your service needs, big or small in New Jersey, with a full service division, from boiler changeouts, main sewer line snakeouts, cameraing main lines, to a simple faucet leak, Gluck Plumbing Service Division has you covered. Give them a call, 732-523-1836, extension 1. Again, 732-523-1836, extension 1. If anyone has any questions or comments or wants to sponsor a show or support the show, please email me, sfarimchatter@gmail.com. And in particular, any comments about the Shabbat Tzvi series? I've gotten a lot of comments in particular so far already from a lot of listeners. So if anyone has any comments or questions, they can let me know. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Sfarim Chatter podcast. On this episode of the podcast, I'm going to be joined by Professor Yaakov Dweck, who is a professor of history and Judaic studies at Princeton University. And we'll be having a conversation focused on his newest book, which is Dissident Rabbi, The Life of Jacob Sosportis. And I guess mainly focus on his work, Tzitzis Nevel Tzvi, but obviously on more than that as well. So thank you very much, Professor Dweck, for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Nafi.
So let's start off a little bit. Tell the listeners about a little bit about yourself and your background.
I teach at Princeton University, where I've been teaching since 2008. And I teach a lecture course on modern Jewish history, where we begin in the 17th century and we end with the Sotmers in Kiryas Yoel in the late 20th century. And before I got my job at Princeton University, I was a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania. And before that, I was a graduate student at the University of Cambridge. And before that, I was an undergraduate at Columbia University.
Very nice. So let's go right into Sosportis. Obviously, you have another book as well on the I think it's called The Scandal of Kabbalah, right? On Yudari Eliana Modena, but we'll not get into that. So, you know, how, when, and why did you get into Sosportis? We'll get into him in a minute, but how did you get there?
It's an interesting question. It was a suggestion that someone had given me many years ago to read and to look at Sosportis. And I was too young at the time to understand why it was such an important subject. And after I had finished working on Modena, I wanted to stay in the 17th century. And one of the things that I enjoyed about Modena was that he was a figure who was oppositional to a lot of the trends of his time period, but he stayed within the tradition. And Sosportis is also a figure who is oppositional, but he stayed within the tradition. And that was the bridge between Modena and Sosportis. The difference was that Modena is probably the most celebrated early modern Jew who ever lived. We know more about him than we know about it, probably any other Jew who lived in the 17th century, with the possible exception of Glückel of Hamelin. But Sosportis was someone who people knew about him. Sholem had written about him extensively as an opponent of Shabbatai Tzvi, but the work hadn't been done in terms of figuring out where he had been, when, and why, how he had moved around. And so that presented its own kind of challenge to write a kind of book about him that involved reconstructing his life and following where he lived rather than simply analyzing just one text.
Got it. Okay, so why don't we start off? We'll tell the listeners who are familiar may not be familiar with him, and he lived his life entirely, I mean, almost the entire 17th century. So talk a little bit about him and his life.
So as you mentioned, his life spans almost the entirety of the 17th century. He's born, depending on which source you trust, either around 1610 or around 1614. And he's born in Oran, which is modern-day Algeria, the city of Wahran. It's important to realize, though, that in the early 17th century, Oran was a presidio of the Iberian Empire, of the Spanish Empire, which basically means that it was a frontier town that had a fortress and it had soldiers, and it was an outpost of the Spanish Empire in North Africa. The town was largely a Christian town, largely Catholic town, and there were some Jews. Sasportas' family had fled Aragon in 1391 after the riots, and they had been living in North Africa for roughly 2.5 centuries, from the late 1391 roughly until the early 17th century. There were two ruling families of the Jews of Oran, the Sasportas family and the Cansino family. And the rabbi, Jacob Sasportas, the one who I wrote about, was one of several Jacob Sasportases who lived in the 17th century. He had a very thorough rabbinic education. This we know because he was serving on a Bet Din when he was in his late teens, and he was the head of the Bet Din when he was in his 20s. He moves from Oran further south to a town called Tlemcen. And then at a certain point in the late 1640s, he's forced to flee North Africa. And we don't know why. There are two conflicting accounts, and both of these conflicting accounts are published half a century after the fact. So they can be used, but they have to be used with a lot of caution. He flees Oran and Tlemcen, or he flees North Africa, and he ends up in Amsterdam. And it's only after a period of time that he's able to get his family redeemed from captivity and joining him in Amsterdam. And he stays in Amsterdam for the better part of a decade. And he comes into a very different situation than he's in North Africa. In Amsterdam, there are many Talmidei Chachamim. There is a surfeit of talent, and he's not needed. So he looks around for a job, and he finds a job in a printing house where he works with Menashe ben Israel. He's the typesetter for Menashe ben Israel's most important Hebrew book called Nishmat Chaim. And he also writes some responsa, but he can't really find a job. In the late 1650s, he goes back to North Africa, unlike a lot of the other rabbinic figures who leave North Africa and enter Europe in the early modern period and never to return to North Africa. He actually returns to North Africa. But this time he returns to the Atlantic coast, to Salé. And Salé in the 17th century is its own republic. And Sasportas is in Salé for a number of years, where, again, he works as a posek, and he is probably there as the factor for one of the Portuguese families in Amsterdam who are doing business with North Africa. The Dutch are trading guns with the Republic of Salé, and the Jews are very important go-betweens in this trade. He then flees Salé for a famine and goes back to Amsterdam for a very short time, and then is in London, where he is the first rabbi of the newly reestablished Portuguese Jewish community. And he gets into a number of bitter disputes with the Portuguese Jews in London. But then he flees London again, not because of famine and not because of violence, but because of the plague. Around 9,000 people per week are dying in London in the summer of 1665, and he flees. He flees to Hamburg, where he lives for 6 years. And it's in Hamburg that he writes his great book, Tzitzat Novel Tzvi, where he witnesses the Sabbatian upheavals. But then he goes back from Hamburg to Amsterdam, where he works in Amsterdam for a while as a rabbi. But finally, he seems to get his job that he's been looking for a long time in 1678 when he moves to Livorno. But then too, in Livorno, he has a fight. And he goes back to Amsterdam. And then for the last 18 years of his life, he lives in Amsterdam. Eventually, he becomes the Rosh Yeshiva after Yitzhak Abba de Fonseca steps down as the Rosh Yeshiva. And eventually, after Yitzhak Abba de Fonseca dies, he becomes the chief rabbi of the Portuguese Jews for about 4.5 years before his death in 1698. So he is one of the points that is very important about him that Matt Goldish made in a really wonderful article about him is that Sasportas is the only rabbi to occupy a position in all four major centers of the Sephardic diaspora in Western Europe, Amsterdam, Hamburg, London, and Livorno. And all four of these cities, Hesportas occupies a major position, and he also travels back and forth between North Africa and Europe.
Something else, something that's interesting when you kind of alluded to this, is that he's a little different, not unique. Obviously, Mortera and Pardo, I think, were also, they were kind of from Italy, or from, Pardo was from Salonica, I don't remember. But he was not a from a Converso family. He was from a Sephardic family that always, you know, was and never was no Converso. So he wasn't exactly similar in that regard to most of the constituents, I guess, where he worked, right?
So this is a very important point that you pick up on, Nafi. And this is an experiential difference as well as a intellectual difference. The community, or I don't like to use the word community because it gives us the sense of that it's voluntary, and as if they're sort of Jews on the Upper West Side having a nice time. And that's not what this is. There are no choices in the 17th, or there are not these kinds of choices in the 17th century. This Portuguese Jewish settlement is a new settlement in Amsterdam, and it's a settlement of new Jews. And the title of one of Professor Yosef Kaplan's wonderful books is From New Christians to New Jews. So you have a whole group of people who had experience as Catholics, who had lived lives as Catholics, either them or their parents or their grandparents. And then they return to the Judaism of their ancestors, whether it's their grandparents, their great grandparents. So they had experienced life as Christians. And that being said, the rabbinic establishment is split. Some of them had experienced life as Christians, or had been born into families that have experienced life as Christians, such as Menashe ben Israel, Yitzhak Abba of the Fonseca, and others had been imported talent. Right. This is a problem, or not a problem. This is a phenomenon that we have throughout the early modern period. And then it continues in the modern period, where you have rabbis who move around and are brought by money or prestige or both, or some promise of some combination thereof, to a settlement of Jews. And many of the rabbis, not Abba of the Fonseca and not Menashe ben Israel, but people like you mentioned, Mortera and Pardo and Sasportas, had lived their entire lives as Jews. What's interesting, one of the things that separates someone like Sasportas from Mortera, Yosef Kaplan proved many years ago, I believe in the 1970s, that Mortera was from an Ashkenazi family from Italy. Sasportas was from a Sephardic family, from a Sephardic family whose ancestors had included Nachmanides, the Ramban. So he was not wowed by the sort of stories of ancestries that the Portuguese Jews were telling about themselves in Amsterdam in the 17th century. And I think this led to a lot of conflict between him and his constituents.
Right. And that's something I think that, not only that, but I mean, kind of you pick up, I think, throughout the book, is that, I mean, his overall personality, something that comes out through Titus Neuvel Zvi and all different places, and through the Chopstick Zvi, that whole discussion. So I guess, I mean, we can discuss that a little bit as we discuss more Titus Neuvel Zvi and the story. So obviously what he's, I guess, known for now, and you discuss a little bit in the book, was he known for then after the fact, but kind of he was known from the whole Chopstick Zvi story. So I think, I guess, kind of quickly, just to kind of relate that.
So I think it's worth stepping back and thinking about what's going on in the 17th century. The Jews are in exile. There is a massive amount of violence in Europe around the 30 Years' War. There is famine. There is a huge amount of movement. Adam Teller has just written an extraordinary book about the refugee crisis of the 17th century, of which Jews were a really, really crucial part. And so you have stories that are emerging, and news reports and rumors that the Messiah has come. And this Messiah is not some random lunatic. He was a rabbi. He was a serious Talmid Chacham. We know from a really extraordinary article by Maoz Kahana and Sion that Shabtai Tzvi knew what he was doing. He was a serious Talmid Chacham. He was a rabbi. And we have reports. You have reports that the entire rabbinic establishment in the Ottoman Empire believes that the Messiah has come, and Jews are starting to dance in the street. So imagine if you walk into synagogue and you hear all of a sudden that reputable sources from families that you know of, because they have branches in the cities that you live in, are reporting that the Messiah has arrived. Most people would be pretty happy. And Sasportas' initial response to this is guarded optimism. He's willing to believe. Look, if the Messiah is willing to behave according to the way he is described by Maimonides at the end of his code of law, then great. I believe that Shabtai Tzvi, I'm willing to believe that Shabtai Tzvi is the Messiah. This movement, though, doesn't take place in one day, and it doesn't take place in a week. It unfolds over about a period of around 15 to 16 months, depending on how long the mail takes to get to a particular place, a little bit over a year, let's say. And as the reports come in over the course of time period, you start to have reports of increasing antinomian activity. And the antinomian activity collects around a whole number of things, the sort of recitation of the divine name, the ritual slaughter of sacrifice. But I think one of the really crucial things, one of the really crucial litmus tests is eating on a fast day. Right? This starts with the fast day of Asara B'Tevet, or as you would say, Asara B'Teves, and it continues all the way, and in particularly through Shiv Asar B'Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, right? This is, Inyana Dioma, as we would say, right? That, you can't have it both ways. Either you fast because we are living in exile and because we are mourning the destruction of temple, whoever this we is, right? I'm not sure. Or you don't fast because the Messiah has arrived. And once the sport that starts to hear that Shabtai Tzvi and his followers are not fasting, right, that Tisha B'Av becomes a holiday, then he starts saying, no, you've crossed the line. You're not the Messiah. And then he goes on a campaign and he goes on the warpath. And he has a really extraordinary courage in saying, everyone else around him is saying yes, and he says no. And it's important to realize that it's not simply that the hoi polloi or the masses are saying yes. It is the elites who are saying yes. The elites believe that Shabtai Tzvi is the Messiah, and Sasporta says no. And so what happens is he takes very careful notes, and he records letters that he sends to other people and letters that he receives, and he edits them into a chronicle that he calls Tzitzat Novel Tzvi, but he doesn't print it in his lifetime. He puts it in the drawer. But what's important for us to realize is that we would not have a narrative history. We would not be able to write a narrative history, or at least the same way that, you know, Sholem was able to write a narrative history of Shabtai Tzvi, had we not had Sasportas's pretty much contemporaneous narrative in this book called Tzitzat Novel Tzvi.
Now, something else I think we should discuss a little is that you mentioned there is that he opposed, the opposition, and he was the lone kind of opposition. Now, how did he actually do that during the movement? What was his opposition? Was he writing letters? Was he getting up in the local shul? What was he doing?
So it's important to realize that there are probably other people who have doubts about Shabtai Tzvi, but aren't willing to be as local about it. So he has rabbinic colleagues who are in Venice, like Shmuel Aboab, who are probably quite skeptical about Shabtai Tzvi, but are not really willing to voice their skepticism. The way his opposition manifests itself is by letter writing. He writes to his colleagues and he criticizes them. And he writes really blistering prose. You have to be a very learned man, and you have to know the Bible by heart and know rabbinic literature really well in order to understand his letters. And so he will write letters to people saying, how dare you believe, how dare you be so certain in your belief in Shabtai Tzvi? And then, his colleagues will respond to him and say, no, you should be quiet yourself. Why are you telling us that we shouldn't be so enthusiastic about Shabtai Tzvi? People are actually repenting. The Beit Midrash is filled. This is a good thing. And you have to give his colleagues credit. They have a point. Right? People are starting to show up to synagogue. People are starting to repent. People are starting to study Talmud or Gemara all day long. This is a good thing for a rabbi, right? But Sasportas says, no, look, you don't understand. If they repent, but their repentance is based on a false idea of a Messiah who turns out not to be the Messiah, then they're jeopardizing the idea of repentance, of proper repentance. And he's saying doubt is a really crucial repository of the imagination. Doubt is a really, really crucial repository of actual genuine repentance. And this is something that annoys his colleagues. So he uses the mail and he gets up in synagogue. Those are the ways that he expresses his dissent.
And like you're saying, he was kind of, there were others that had doubts, but he was the main vocal kind of dissenter here.
I believe so. I mean, look, it could be that we'll find, you know, a manuscript of someone else, or a cachet of letters of another rabbi or another, you know, another, it doesn't necessarily, not necessarily a Jew, someone else who really did not believe in Shabtai Tzvi. But as in terms of the evidence at our disposal right now, the main sources, Sesportis is the primary doubter.
Now, I will get into the content in a minute, but one other thing here regarding the letters is who was he mainly in contact with? And was what, because you said a lot of this was in the Sephardic diaspora, so to speak, was he in contact with anybody in Ashkenazi lands and mainly Ashkenazi communities?
So he's mainly in contact with the Sephardic rabbinate in Amsterdam, some in Venice. I believe he is in contact with some Ashkenazi rabbis. He's also in contact with some rabbis in Izmir. If I remember correctly, I don't have the book right at my disposal right now, but I think that he exchanges letters with a number of Ashkenazi rabbis over the course of the year and a half.
Now, regarding the content, so he goes and he opposes Shabtai Tzvi, obviously. So you mentioned this earlier. He talks about the Rambam, Maimonides, and his opinion of Mashiach. So interestingly, he doesn't say he doesn't believe in Mashiach, right? He obviously says he does, and that's part of this here, but he kind of like clarifies that. So you want to talk a little bit about that?
So this is very important, and this is a very important distinction. Sesportis is not willing to give up on the Messianic idea. He's not willing to say, I don't believe in the Messiah. That is not what he is saying. He's saying, I believe in the Messiah, but Shabtai Tzvi is not the Messiah. It's a really, really crucial thing. And I think Sesportis, I'm not sure, because it's not clear to me that Sesportis had actually read the account of Nachmanides' account of his disputation in Barcelona. But there is a line in that disputation where Nachmanides says, look, the Messiah is not that crucial a doctrine. It's not that big a deal, so to speak. I think Sesportis would have probably agreed with something along those lines. But for Sesportis, you have a messianic scenario that is described by Maimonides at the end of his Code of Law, right? The Messiah will be a political figure. He will wage wars. He will give signs and witnesses to his people. He will bring the exiles in. He will do a whole checklist of things, right? And this Messiah, Shabtai Tzvi, is not doing any of these things. So therefore, he's not the Messiah. There's a script for Sesportis. And the Sabbateans, Shabtai Tzvi and Nathan of Gaza, are not sticking to the script. And therefore, Shabtai Tzvi is not the Messiah.
Another interesting thing regarding the Rambam that you point out in your book is that, first of all, he doesn't draw a distinction between the Rambam as a halachist in the halacha works and in Mer Nevuchim and in his philosophy works. And also...
He didn't read Twersky.
What did you say?
He didn't read Twersky.
And the other thing is that he also was a Kabbalist, and you talk about he was a Mekubal. There's an introduction to a Sefer, and he's called a Mekubal. So he kind of like takes those two things kind of together.
He didn't study at the Hebrew University either. Look, I think one of the things that's so complicated about Sesportis, and one of the reasons why he's such a difficult character, is that he scrambles the categories that we, and by we I mean people living in the 20th or the 21st century. Tend to look at the early modern period with. So one, the first is he is not willing to give up on either the Guide of the Perplexed or the Code of Law. For Maimonides, for him, is both books, right? Both books are really critical. He has both books on his bookshelf. And he's not willing to say, oh, Maimonides is only a philosopher, you know, a la Harry Wolfson, or Maimonides is only a halachist, a la Israel Twersky. No, he's both. That's one. The other is, he is a halachist. He's a posek. He's the most important posek in the Sephardic diaspora in the 17th century. Full stop. There's no question. Certainly in the Western Sephardic diaspora. If you've spent any time with his response to Ohel Yaakov, you could tell that they're not a walk in the park. He's someone who really knew his stuff. He doesn't enter into the sort of bloodstream of halacha the way that someone like Yair Chaim Bachrach, his contemporary, the Chavot Yair, does, or even someone like, you know, a century later, like the Pnei Yehoshua. His book doesn't have that kind of purchase, or the Nudah B'Yudah, right? But that doesn't mean it's not written at an extremely sophisticated level, and it also doesn't mean that he doesn't know what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. It just didn't enter into the sort of stream of halacha the way I'm not sure someone like Ovadia Yosef has. But he's also a Kabbalist. right? In his eulogy for, I think it's Mercado, he's referred to as Chachamu Mekubal, right? He is a Kabbalist. He does She'elat Halom. He reads the Zohar. He quotes the Zohar. And these are the he is not someone who thinks Kabbalah was a scandal, right? He thinks Kabbalah is the word of God. And this is really complicated because, you know, the with the scholarship that I grew up on and that I still read and still really and is still very, very important, you know, Yaakov Katz's Halakha v'Kabbalah, it's bifurcated. But I think for him, it's not. I think probably for him, it's much closer to Tashma's Hanigleshe Banistar, where he talks about the Shkiei Halakha, the sort of echoes of Halakha in the Zohar. I think that is sort of the world that Sosworthos is coming from.
Now, something else is obviously a key figure in the Sabbatian movement was Nathan of Gaza being a prophet. And that's another thing where he doesn't say there's no prophecy anymore, right? It's something else that he's still receptive to, but it's not Nathan. So talk about that.
So that's a really good point. So first of all, it's important to understand Nathan of Gaza is 23 years old or 22 years old when this whole thing starts. And Sosworthos is in his 40s or 50s, right? If he's born in 1610 and it starts in 1665, so he's roughly, or if he's born in 1614, so he's, you know, 51, 55, whatever else it is. Imagine a 55-year-old man sees a 23-year-old start a youth movement that, you know, has some messianic pretensions. He's not going to be so happy. So that I think there is an element of Sosworthos' annoyance that a sort of young upstart. But we know from all of the work done on Nathan of Gaza over the years, both by Tishbe, by some of Tishbe's students, Nathan of Gaza was not an idiot. He was a very learned man. And Nathan of Gaza saw himself and was seen by others as a prophet. And I think you see this correctly, that Sosworthos is, again, not willing to give up on the idea of prophecy. He thinks that prophecy is a legitimate way of attaining knowledge in the middle of the 17th century. The way, I have to say, probably most European intellectuals thought that prophecy was a way of legitimate way of attaining knowledge in the 17th century. But he's not willing to concede that Sabbateanism or Nathan of Gaza, for that matter, are legitimate prophets.
I think one last thing about the content, you discuss this in the book also, that he does kind of conflate, does he draw a parallel between Sabbateanism and Christianity? Is that right?
Yes. So, I mean, I think here in Sosworthos has absolutely no patience with Christianity. And he basically says, look, this movement is doing the same thing to Judaism that the Jesus movement did in the, he doesn't think about the first century as such, but in sort of the rabbinic period, so to speak. And Sosworthos thinks that we meaning people living in the 17th century, not people living in the 21st century talking over Zoom, we are still in the middle of the Jewish-Christian conflict. And the Sabbatean idea puts Judaism at risk. And to concede, the whole metaphor of the suffering servant or the whole passage of the suffering servant is really, really quite crucial for Sosworthos. And he holds his ground and he says, look, this is like Christianity. And I think this is in one respect, if there's one overlap between Modena and Sosworthos, is I think that they both take Christianity very, very seriously. And they do not have this illusion that, you know, the Jewish-Christian conflict is over and now we're all going to get along in some really wonderful kumbaya society. It's like, no, they take this very, very seriously. Sabbateanism is a form of Christianity. And Sosworthos has no patience for this.
Now, you mentioned this before, but it's just, you know, after this is so, once this is finished, kind of, so to speak, does he still, he doesn't publish the work and he just kind of goes along with things, eventually becomes a rabbi in Amsterdam. That's like it, right?
So this is a question. What are the conventions of the dissemination of knowledge in a particular time period? Sosworthos was someone who had worked in the printing industry. He knew what it was to print a book. He had aspirations and ambitions to publish his writing. We know that he kept his responsa in a single particular manuscript, which now exists at Yeshiva University. You can go and see it if you want, for Ohel Yaakov. So we know that he was highly attuned to the conventions of publication. He didn't publish Tzitzat Novel Tzvi as a printed book. The question is why? The answer is we don't know. I think it has to do with a number of reasons. One is crude materialism. It was very expensive to publish a book as long as Tisza Novel Tzvi. And so Sforza had money at various points in his life, but it could be that he didn't want to part with the money at a particular time period to pay for it. So it could be, I don't know. As likely an answer having, or as likely a reason as the issue of cost has to do with the content of the book, which is that it doesn't exactly depict the Jewish elites in the most positive of lights. So he may have done something what Amnon Rados Karkotkin talks about, the internal censorship of not wanting to publish his writing because lest it show his co-religionists in a very bad light, lest it show him in a light that he doesn't want to see. We don't know why he doesn't publish it. A truncated version appears in print in 1737 after he dies, 39 years after he dies, as an appendix to his responsa. Every single copy of his responsa that I have ever seen, with one exception, has had this appendix ripped out. The one exception is in the Sholem Library. There is a photo offset reprint of Ohel Yaakov that was published in Brooklyn in the late 20th century that includes the entirety of the appendix. So now it's a very easy thing to find. You can find it on Hebrew Books. You can download it at the click of a mouse. But in the early modern period itself, it was very difficult to find the Kitzur of Tzitzat Novel Tzvi. It's gone. It's cut out from almost every single copy to such a degree that Jacob Emden, who is someone who knew something about Hebrew printing and who was interested in amassing a pretty large collection of books, had no idea about the existence of Kitzur Tzitzat Novel Tzvi until he was sent into exile himself from Altona, Hamburg, and ends up in Amsterdam, where he describes himself in the introduction to the book as Orech Natal Alun. You see Emden is quoting Agnon, and he says, I was here and I found this copy of Kitzur Tzitzat Novel Tzvi, so I decided I'm going to re-edit it, and then he reissues it. And once Emden reissues it, the book is very easily accessible.
Now, you mentioned Yaakov Emden, the Ivid, so you say he went and he published it. That was obviously while he was embroiled in the controversy.
In the middle of the controversy, yes, absolutely.
Right in the middle, when he went to Amsterdam. So why did he decide to publish it? And did he view himself as similar? The same name he talks about, and did he view himself as similar? And you, looking at writing a book now in the 21st century, I think you talk about this, they're not exactly the same.
So it's very important to understand. Emden is a really complicated character. And to the extent that I have any understanding of Emden, it has only to do with his edition of Sasportas's Kitzur Tzitzat Novel Tzvi, which he edits. He re-edits the book. It's not simply that he republishes it in a photo offset edition. He actually enters into the text and makes changes. Moreover, he also includes marginal annotations. He also takes some of the responsa that Sasportas has in Ohel Yaakov and publishes them as an appendix to the book. He actually creates a genuine edition of the book. Emden is a very complicated figure. He edits Sasportas as part of his fight with Jonathan Eibeschitz. His fight with Jonathan Eibeschitz starts in 1751, and it's not clear that it ever really ends. Eibeschitz dies in about 15 years later in the middle of the 1760s. I think it's 1766, but Wikipedia will tell us the precise date of Eibeschitz's death. And Emden dies in the 1770s, in 1778, I believe. And for the rest of, certainly most of Emden's life and all of Eibeschitz's life, Emden is on a warpath. I'm not going to weigh in as to whether or not Eibeschitz was a Sabbatian or not. I don't think that is an important question, but I think an equally as important question is, what does it mean to be a Sabbatian in the middle of the 1750s? Because to be a Sabbatian in the middle of the 1750s is not the same thing as to be a Sabbatian in the middle of the 1660s. Most Jews in 1665 and 1666 were Sabbatians. By 1751, it's a different animal already. It's a different thing. Emden discovers these amulets of Eibeschitz, declares that they are Sabbatian, and then goes on the warpath. And Emden really tries to rally the entire European rabbinate. And Professor Lyman has written article after extraordinary article about this controversy. You can go and read them there. You should read each and every one of them. I will say this, that Emden is a heresy hunter. He goes after people. He examines them. He wants to make sure that, you know, he gets it right, so to speak. Sesportis is not a heresy hunter. Sesportis was a dissident. He was someone who was against the trend. He was not interested. And one of the differences between Emden and Sesportis is after Shabtai Tzvi converts to Islam and the movement fizzles out, Sesportis stops writing about Sabbateanism. But he doesn't suddenly become a nice man and, you know, he's not suddenly the old guy in the back of the synagogue, you know, who, you know, gives out candy. No, he continues to fight. He's in the fight over, he's in the, you know, the rabbinic fray throughout the next 30 years of his life. He dies in 1698. He's still fighting into his 1690s. Because why? Because for Sesportis's fight is how to read Maimonides. It's not about Shabtai Tzvi. For Emden, the fight was about Shabtai Tzvi. And that is a really, really crucial difference between the two of them. There are other differences, right? Emden has a relationship with his father that is extremely complicated, and he writes at great length about his father. We know nothing about Sesportis' father. Nothing. We don't know anything about him. Emden had a relationship with printing that Sesportis didn't have. There are some really, really crucial differences. I think there are certain, you know, real similarities that the two of them are these sort of vitriolic, very learned, really funny, you know, when read in a particular kind of way, learned rabbis.
By the way, Wikipedia says Rabbi Yonah Sanayevich has died September 18, 1764. Whether that's correct.
1764. Okay, thank you. I should know my facts before I go and agree to being on Sfarim Chatter podcast. Thank you. So he died in 1764. So the point is, for the last 13 years of Eibeschitz's life, he's embroiled in this fight. And then for the next however many years, I think it's a decade and a half, that Emden is alive after Eibeschitz dies. Emden's not done fighting just because Eibeschitz is dead, right?
Right, absolutely. So I think two other things, that there's other parts in your book that you discuss. We don't have to discuss. If you want to mention, you discuss Sholem, obviously, and Sholem's interpretation of Sesportis and that. And you also discuss somehow you got to the Samara of Rabbi Teitelbaum also, right?
So who do we want to talk about first, Sholem or Teitelbaum? Let's talk about Sholem first. Sholem was a German Jewish intellectual who moves to Palestine and becomes a professor and writes this really great book in the late 50s in Hebrew, two volumes called Shabtai Tzvi, and then it's translated into English and it appears in English in one volume in 1973 called Shabtai Tzvi, the Mystical Messiah. What I tried to trace in the book, because we have a lot of archival material about this, was how Sholem thought about Shabtai Tzvi through his reading of Sesportis. And that Sholem was deeply ambivalent about Shabtai Tzvi, and he was deeply ambivalent about Sesportis. And that he thought with, he thought against, he thought through Sesportis as he was trying to understand Shabtai Tzvi. Sholem was extremely attracted to the antinomian aspects of Shabtai Tzvi. In the very early essay or relatively early essay that Mitzvah Haba Be'Avera, Redemption Through Sin, he writes about the sort of the aftermath of what happens after Shabtai Tzvi's conversion. And then over the next 20 years, he continues to write about Shabtai Tzvi and he gathers material for this sort of great big book. One of the things that he does, though, is he also changes the state of play in terms of the primary sources available. He sends Tishbi to edit Sesportis' chronicle. He has the Yiddish chronicle by Leib ben Oizer, Maisa von Shabtai Tzvi, via Zalman Shazar. And then he also has Nathan of Gaza's writings. So Sholem really changed the map in terms of the primary sources that were available for him to write this account of Shabtai Tzvi, and Sesportis was a really crucial figure in this account. I think Sesportis was someone who Sholem had profound problems with because Sholem had a real Maimonides problem. And Sesportis was sort of the living testament of Maimonides within Sabbateanism. So that was one of the things I tried to sort of trace and reconstruct Sholem's relationship with Sesportis, Tishbi's relationship with Sholem, and then Tishbi's relationship with Sesportis. I should say that Tishbi's edition of Sesportis, which takes a very long time to appear in print and finally does in 1954 with Mossad Bialik, is a monument of textual scholarship.
It is one of the greatest editions of any text I've ever read. It's really genuinely mind-blowing. Let's turn, though, to another Jew from the Habsburg Empire, Joel Teitelbaum. So Joel Teitelbaum is born in 1887, dies, I think, in 1979. Wikipedia can tell us. I think the dates are correct. And he's a Hasidic Rebbe. He's the Satmar Rav. And he is known already well before the Second World War as a firebrand, as a rabbinic firebrand. He's also known for his principled and deeply studied anti-Zionism. I believe it is in the late 50s, he writes a book called Vayoel Moshe. And he writes this book, I think it appears four times over the course of his lifetime. He continues to add to it over the course of his life. And Vayoel Moshe is an attack on Zionism from within the halachic tradition. And it's an argument that Zionism is a perversion of Judaism. And Teitelbaum reasons by analogy. And he basically makes an argument, look, the same way that Sasporta stood up and said to all the Sabbateans that they are worshiping false gods, I say to you, all the Zionists, that you're worshiping false gods. And like Emden, he casts himself as a sort of latter-day Sasportas. And that was one of the things that I tried to show, was that here you have these two Jewish intellectual giants of the middle of the 20th century, Gershom Scholem and Joel Teitelbaum. And both of them are thinking through the problem of the Messiah through Sasportas and Tzitzit Novel Tzvi at almost the same time, right? I think Vayoel Moshe appears in the late 1950s and Scholem Shabtai Tzvi appears for sure in the late 1950s. And they're both working through this issue. I have heard, and I have no textual evidence for this, but given that this is a podcast and not a book, I feel comfortable saying this. I have heard that Teitelbaum knew Tishbe when Tishbe was in Hungary before the war, and didn't have such fond feelings towards him, which would make sense. Tishbe was a poet. He was a Zionist. He left in, I believe, the 30s to go to Palestine and to study at the university. And Tishbe was a Bachur Yeshiva. He knew what he was doing. What was interesting to me was that here you had these two intellectual Zionists, Scholem and Teitelbaum, who are trying to think through the problem of Zionism via Sasportas.
Right, interesting. So just want to mention a little bit about the actual Tzitzit Novel Tzvi, because it is Sfarim Chatter podcast. We'll talk a little bit about that, and everything, all Sasportas is seen through the book, really. So like you mentioned, the Tshuvas, the Tshuvot Ol Yaakov, was published one time, and then there was that photo offset. I don't think the copy, I don't think it's really around, but it's on Hebrew Books. Anyone can download it. Tzitzit Novel Tzvi, like you said, it was the Kitzer, which was kind of like truncated and kind of played around with, was in there. And then there's Yaakov Emden's, and then there's Tishbe's, which has been out of print for like 60 years, and good luck getting a copy. And there's no rhyme or reason. I don't know if anyone knows why it's still out of print, but do you want to talk a little bit about Tishbe's edition, a little more about what he did there and how he kind of made it into the complete
edition? I'd be happy to talk about Tishbe's edition. Tishbe's edition is a monument of scholarship. And in order to understand what Tishbe was doing, we need to step back a second. There was an entire transcription by Sasportas of Tzitzit Novel Tzvi that was in Vienna that the librarian in Vienna, Arthur Zacharias Schwartz, was using to prepare an edition. There was another manuscript that was in Berlin that was Sasportas' notes for the letters that were going to appear in Tzitzit Novel Tzvi, a sort of first draft. Schwartz was working in Vienna. He published a catalog of the Hebrew manuscripts. He published several catalogs of the Hebrew manuscripts in Vienna. They're monuments of scholarship. They're used to this day. In one of the catalogs, he announces that he's preparing this edition. The Nazis take power in Vienna, and Schwartz flees. And he ends up in Palestine. And he dies in Palestine in 1939, right very shortly after his arrival. And his widow knew of correspondence between Scholem and Schwartz and turns to Scholem and says, look, Schwartz
had this entire transcription of this manuscript by Sesportas. Can you do something with it? Can you actually publish it as a book? Sholem had an institute for the study of Kabbalah that was funded by Shokin. And one of the workers at this institute was Tishbe. Sholem assigned Tishbe to do this edition. And in the early stages of the project, Sholem was going to write the introduction to this book. Tishbe took Schwartz's transcription of the Vienna manuscript and compared it to the photographs of the Berlin manuscript that had Sesportas's first drafts. And he produced an edition of the text that gives you the text of Sesportas and then the variants from the first edition in the margins. He also gives you textual sources in footnotes to the book. The Berlin manuscript that had photographs that Tishbe had photographs of Sesportas's first draft was lost in the war and was thought to be gone. It showed up at auction in the 1980s at Sotheby's, and Yeshiva University bought it for a song. I think, I don't know, $20,000, $15,000, $25,000, whatever it was a song. The Vienna manuscript, to the best of my knowledge, has never resurfaced. And is lost. But Schwartz's transcription was quite thorough, and Tishbe had copies of Schwartz's transcription. So what Tishbe was doing in his edition was using Schwartz's materials, comparing them to the photographs of the Berlin manuscript, and editing the text. And that's what he did. And he had originally hoped to publish the book with Shokin. Shokin promised him that he would publish it, then reneged on the promise. And then Tishbe sent it to Mossad Bialik, and Mossad Bialik accepted it, and it appeared eventually in 1954. But it was ready for publication, I believe, in 1946 or 1947.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about it in the introduction, and like I said, it's still not in print. So now it hasn't been published since then.
Been published since then. Look, it is available in most good libraries. Most good Judaica libraries at a university will have it. The National Library in Jerusalem has it. You can find it at most good libraries. So it's not, I mean, if you want to find the text, it's not impossible to find the way it was in the 17th century or the 18th century. But yes, it's a book that should be republished. I don't think we need a new edition of it. We just simply need to republish it.
Right, exactly. They just need to reissue. And one last thing you mentioned with Sesportas. So that was the whole controversy. The manuscript, someone held them and then he sold them. I think there is the Ol Yaakov manuscript there also. Is there other manuscripts from him now that are at Yeshiva University?
Yeshiva University owns two manuscripts of Sesportas. One is the printer's edition of Ohel Yaakov. It's Sesportas' text that the printers used to print Ohel Yaakov. And there are a couple of things in that manuscript that didn't end up appearing in the text, but by and large, it's pretty similar to the printed text. Then there are the notes for the first draft of Tzitzit Novel Tzvi. Are there other manuscripts of Sesportas? There's a manuscript of Sesportas' son in Amsterdam, which we know about. I don't know of other ones, to the best of my knowledge, but I could be wrong.
Right, I think one of the
things that I found, and in the years of working on him, is that we have a fair number of notarial documents, and we have a fair number of documents in the archival holdings of the Jewish settlements in which he lived, where Sesportas' signature appears. I mean, his signature appears on countless number of kitubot and Livorno. It appears all over in Amsterdam. He appears in a whole number of notarial documents. I mean, look, if you want to go and, you know, Sesportas is a rabbi with whom, if you want to actually go and find where he was at particular time periods, there is material. I mean, there is material that, you know, you can go and find.
Speaking of his son, I think the third volume of the Kitvei Yitzchak Avov Daf Fonseca just was published by Mechon Yerushalayim, V'chach Me'Recipi V'Amsterdam, they called it. It's not really him, it's a lot of, and there is a Hesped there that his son gave for him that was just published for manuscript.
Yes.
That just
yes.
came out a few months ago.
Yeah.
So I'll mention that. Okay, so I ask you the final question. Are there any future projects that you're working on? Are you still staying in the 17th century?
I hope to do an edition of Ari Nohem with the text by Modena, where there is a need for a new edition of the text, because we have a lot more manuscripts than were available to Nechemia Leibovitz. And as for that, I mean, as for other projects, I mean, once I do the edition of Modena, we'll see. But that might take me the better part of the next 10 years. So we'll see.
Is that planning to be in Hebrew or in English?
I hope to do an edition of the Hebrew text with an English translation, but I have to find a publisher first.
Sounds good. Okay, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.